The Team Never Quit podcast is sponsored by Navy Federal Credit Union. Navy Federal Credit Union likes to reward their members for using their credit cards. Learn more at NavyFederal.org.
Team Never Quit Radio.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Team Never Quit podcast. Hanging out today with Marcus and Melanie in the studio. What's up, everybody?
What's happening?
What is happening? How was y'all's weekend?
Awesome, blessed and unstoppable, man. We had a blast. I just stayed home,
chilled, relaxed, kicking it. That's awesome.
Melly had she had a busy weekend.
I had a busy weekend, but it was great. I loved it. I loved everybody. It was just a really fun time.
That's so great.
I miss my husband.
Aw. Hey, we've got a great Patreon question today. What is your favorite patriotic song or songs?
Dude, that's a no-brainer.
Come on.
That's just a no-brainer. Jody, you want to go first?
Yeah, Jody, what you think?
Y'all are asking me. It used to be God Bless the USA, but it's so overplayed. I'm just like, oh. But I was at the league. I think it was me and my brother and my mother. We went and saw Barbara Mandrell. And Lee Greenwood opened for Barbara Mandrell in 1984, and he debuted that song but the first time I heard it was at that concert live, and I loved it. I had it on my old tape recorder, my old Walkman, and I would play it over and over and over again.
Same. Mine's Lee Greenwood. I mean, every time, especially him singing it live, it brings tears to my eyes every single time.
Yep, that's mine.
Yep.
I asked, but did you get old Jimmy or Uncle Ted on the guitar playing Star Spangled Banner? But, you know, that's the go-to. That's the first one popped in your head. Wait,
since we all agreed, what would be like the second?
Probably, that's a hard one. I actually have a playlist of patriotic songs.
Is God Bless Texas a patriotic song?
Damn right it is.
That's my favorite.
What are you talking about? He blessed it with his own two hands.
That's right.
If that counts, I'm with you.
Yeah, I was going to throw that out at the beginning. That's tough about it. That and Texas Women.
That's right.
That's a great patriotic song. Thank you, Hank.
I can't think of any.
Well, I know we're missing one.
Who do you think's the best?
Toby Keith's got some good ones.
Yeah.
Putting foot to ass, you know, he can rider some good ones up.
Granger Smith.
Granger's good, yeah.
Brooks and Dunn, Only in America.
Yeah.
That's a good one, man.
Good one.
That's a real good one, actually.
Yeah. There's a lot of really good ones.
Who do you think's the best, who was the best singer with the national anthem?
Ooh. Like ever or like Super Bowl?
Like
or?
Ever. Like,
I got the best and the worst. It's the same person.
Okay.
Fergie.
Oh.
Is that true?
Look up Fergie singing. I want to say it was the Daytona 500. She sang the national anthem, and then she sang like the NBA All-Star game. And the Daytona 500 was incredible. The All-Star game was atrocious.
We all have good days.
Didn't she mess up a word or something the last time she sang?
That's one of the hardest songs to sing, from what I understand. Yeah. So I don't ever say anything about anybody having to sing that thing. Was it Whitney Houston?
Whitney Houston belted it out.
Freaking belted that sucker out, like,
and
spine.
Probably Kelly Clarkson or something.
What about...
My favorite version is Carl Lewis.
What? That...
Carl Lewis.
What, the worst? Roseanne Barr?
Roseanne's up there, but Carl Lewis is... it's my favorite because it's probably the worst, and he was just trying to do so good. And, I mean, you think about it...
I saw that. Olympian. That's right. Okay, I remember that. He was trying real hard.
Oh, he was trying. He had to apologize. All right, I'll do better.
Yeah. He was trying hard.
I think it's on YouTube.
Yeah, we'll pull that up. Good Patreon question. Thank you,
great Patreon question. Hey, if you want to ask your question, join us patreon.com/teamneverquit. You can actually ask your questions to the guest, to the host. You can get some sweet swag. challenge coin, all kind of other cool stuff. Make sure to check that out at patreon.com/teamneverquit. We've got a great guest in store, family, sort of, kind of. Everyone's related in Louisiana, apparently.
Yeah, you know, Mary Sarah does a good job in Nashland.
True that.
She does.
Yes.
She's amazing.
Yeah. We have an incredible guest, Jody Ploche. Did I say it right?
Yep.
Am I good?
Yep.
He shares his experience being kidnapped by his karate teacher.
Don't get this wrong, man.
Don't get this wrong, okay? Being rescued and his father subsequently fatally shooting his abuser on TV. We'll also get to hear about his book, Why, Gary, Why, and his work to educate on sexual violence. Welcome to the show, Jody.
Thank you for having me.
So I found out about you because my sister listens to all the true crime podcasts, and she heard your story on one of those. I don't remember which one it was, but she was telling me about it, and then she said your name, and I was like, first I thought it was a crazy story, and then I was like, wait, if he's a Ploche, he's got to be related. So I looked you up, and the rest is history.
And we're, sure enough,
yeah, related. We're excited to hear your story, and we just, if you just want to kick it off and just tell us, and then we'll pop in and ask questions.
All right, so it started off when I was in fifth grade. I was in class, and they handed us a flyer to take karate. I literally took my karate flyer, and I balled it up and threw it in the garbage on the way out of the class. I remember it to this day. Threw it in the garbage can, and I didn't think nothing about it. Well, my little brother, he went to a different school, and they gave him the same flyer. And he brought that flyer home and gave it to my mother. Well, I was playing sports, football, basketball, maybe softball or baseball at that time, and I didn't think I had time for karate. Well, my little brother, he wasn't into any sports, so my mother thought it would be a good idea to kind of get him involved in something. So she enrolled him, and when she enrolled him, she enrolled my older brother and the neighbor friend, her best friend, Miss Eileen, her son, Mark. They enrolled him too. So it was me, Mikey, Bubba, and Mark that went to go take these karate lessons. And we went to the first lesson, and it went fine. We went to the second lesson, and the karate teacher didn't show up. We went to the third lesson, he didn't show up again. So the organization that had created these karate lessons turned our name over to another young up-and-coming karate teacher named Jeff Doucette, and he was going to honor the remain, because I think it was like 10 lessons for $35 or whatever. So he was going to honor the karate lessons. So that's how we ended up sort of taking karate from a man named Jeff Doucette. Well, after we went to a few karate classes at his place, he is explaining to us how they had a karate team. Think of like the Karate Kid, where they go fight in tournaments. And so he invited us to go see the movie They Call Me Bruce, which was a karate movie.
Awesome because movie.
You know what? I'm going to have to rewatch it because I don't remember it being awesome. But
no, it's awesomely bad. That time frame of those movies are so – They Call Me Bruce, right? It was like when he sits down to eat with the nunchucks.
I couldn't block the other things out of my mind, but I think I blocked that movie out of my mind. But like I said, I'm going to rewatch it again. I just got to, speaking of awesomely wonderful, like The Love Boat. Have you watched The Love Boat lately?
Okay, so last week.
Terribly wonderful.
Believe it or not. Last week, somebody brought that up, dude. So I got on YouTube and fired that thing up. The jingle is awesome.
Did you know the last season, Dionne Warwick sang it? It's terrible.
No, I didn't.
Great fact.
I just found that out. I almost cried. I was like, no, the beginning is, it's love, exciting. And the best thing about The Love Boat, when you go back and watch it, is seeing like the people who were in it. Like, you know, Scott Baio when he was like 9 years old, and Charlie's Angels. They did a crossover between Charlie's Angels and The Love Boat, which was awesome. So anyway, so we go see They Call Me Bruce. And after my cousin was having a birthday party at like Chuck E. Cheese or something. So the karate team went over to Chuck E. Cheese, and we all hung out and played games and video games and jumped around in the toys or whatever, watched the rocket fire explosion. And Jeff just seemed like this really great guy. You know, he's, you know, attentive. He told my mother that we were excellent at karate and had a future. And so they bought all of this stuff. And that was just Jeff at that point grooming, not just me, but the family. Cause at this point, Jeff had not touch me at all. And so he just became really liked by the family. So he was welcome to come over on Saturday nights when we'd play trivia. Well, I guess it wasn't Trivial Password is what it was. It eventually led into Trivial Pursuit later. But I mean, the family would get together at my house and just hang out and Daddy would cook and Jeff was, you know, one of us. Well, unbeknownst to them, he was, again, grooming me. It started out, I think, when we were like stretching at karate practice. He like put his hands up. Oh, your thighs are tight and you got to stretch. And so he's grabbing like almost not my crotch, but like on the side of my crotch. And he's going, oh, yeah, you're tight, you're tight. And that was just him kind of working his way into inappropriately touching me. It led up to the point to where he finally started sexually abusing me. I won't say the first time, because I think the grooming, when he's touching me inappropriately, that is sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. But when he really went like full scale, it was in Houston. It was a karate tournament in Houston. And he called me up to the front of the van and he said, come up here. And he told me, basically, I'm going to perform oral sex with you tonight. And I'm 10 years old. And I'm like, I have no clue why he wants to do this. Well, that night, after the movie went off, his old John Wayne movie, turned the TV off, and he just slipped underneath the covers and he performed oral sex with me. He did that probably for about a month. And then he decided, okay, now I'm going to have sex with you. And that was in May. And that went on until, you know, he eventually kidnapped me in February of 1984. And, you know, the rest is history, I guess.
Were you terrified when he started doing that, like the first night that he went under the covers?
Well, I was not happy. I mean, there was obviously like I was freaked out, but I didn't know why he would want to do that. Like, I didn't know at the 10 years old, mm-hmm. I didn't know that, you know, my private parts was for more than just peeing.
Yeah.
You know, and so he went underneath the covers, and it didn't take me long to figure out, oh, wow, this feels wonderful. But it wasn't, and I mentioned this in my book, it wasn't that I was enjoying it, but my body was responding as a human body would.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there was physical pleasure, but there was mental anguish.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's why a lot of survivors of sexual abuse, they have, you know, bad memories because they blame themselves, is because at some point your body is just going to respond like a human body responds. So it doesn't matter whether it's a 100-year-old person, mm-hmm. or a karate teacher or a spouse,
right.
Not a spouse, a partner, that whoever's doing it, it's going to feel good.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean you're enjoying it, because I wasn't enjoying it, but my body was like, hey, heads up.
Oh my gosh. That's so crazy.
So you didn't tell your parents or anything at this?
No, I decided I would just keep quiet. And even after he kidnapped me, am I getting ahead of the story? So
he
kidnapped me in 1984 because he owed money and he was skipping town. And so when he skipped town, he took me with him because I was his love interest for the last year. And even when they arrested him and they brought me back, I still lied and said he didn't touch me. And of course, they probably were clued in that he had, but I lied and lied and lied because I knew I went to the hospital. And I knew eventually the hospital exam would come back and prove that he had. Mm-hmm. So I'd made up my mind that I wasn't going to tell on him because I didn't want him to come after that. I'm thinking at 11 years old.
Yeah. Okay.
But I knew the hospital report would come back. I decided when that came back, I would tell.
Let's go back to the day of the kidnapping.
So the day I was kidnapped was Sunday, February 19th, 1984. He said his brother had dropped him off and he wanted to borrow my mom's car. And his brother was supposed to be installing carpet into one of the other kids in the karate class's parents' house. They were building a house. And he asked my mother, can I borrow your car? She said, yeah. And he said, can Jody come with me? And she said, don't keep him going all day. And we left. And instead of going to look for the carpet, we went to his brother Mike's house and picked up some clothes. And then we took my mother's car from Baton Rouge to Port Arthur, Texas. That's where his mother and sister lived. So we were there. His mother called my mom like that night and said, yeah, Jeff's here with Jody. And my mother was like, he's got school tomorrow. He needs to get home. And Jeff lied to his mom and said, I'll bring you back tomorrow. But he was telling her he was going to New York City. Well, we ended up going to California, to Los Angeles.
My gosh, that is crazy. And then this is back when nobody had cell phones or anything like that. So there was no easy way to just contact your parents or anything.
No, this was, you know, we took a bus from Orange, Texas to Los Angeles, downtown Los Angeles, California, and we had no money. So what eventually happened was Jeff contacted a karate instructor out of Houston. His name is Al Garza. And he told Al that he had taken a trip to California for a tournament and his van was stolen and all of its money was in there. And so Al wired us $600. It ended up being like $550 with the fees that Western Union got. So that was what Jeff had. He had $550, his brother's birth certificate so he could get an identification, and no plan whatsoever.
Were you freaking out at this point, or were you kind of just like along for the ride because you didn't know what was going on?
I was pretty much along for the ride. I mean, he told me that if he doesn't get the money to pay the guy off that he owed, that he was going to go to California and take me with him. So I didn't know that particular day was going to be the day, but I mean, it was almost like, I mean, he took me to Disneyland. So, I mean, even though I was quote unquote kidnapped, it wasn't like I was gagged and bound, thrown in the van and, you know, he's asking ransom for me. I mean, he took me to Disneyland. I got to see the Hollywood sign. I thought that was kind of awesome. We walked around downtown LA and we got to see him film an like a little segment for the TV show Hill Street Blues. So that was kind of cool. You know, I don't want to say I enjoyed it, but I kind of did.
Well, you were also so young. You were what, 10 or 11?
11.
Yeah. I mean, our son is 10. I can't imagine someone just picking up and leaving with him. Your mom had to have been freaking out.
Oh, I made fun of her because she like lost like 20 pounds in the 10 days I was gone. I was like, the kidnap diet is the best diet I've ever seen. She showed up to nothing.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, she had to have been losing her mind, especially back then when you couldn't track phones or anything like that. I would have lost my mind.
So he was good to you while you were on the trip.
It was like he was trying to be a partner.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, other than the few times he had sex with me on the trip, I would say, you know, I mean, he wasn't in his mind, he was in love with me. I mean, that's how pedophiles are.
Yeah, like he thinks that he's doing a good thing. Like, it's like you're a boyfriend. And you were so young that you don't understand any of it. And it's like, oh, well, I get to see cool things I've never seen before.
Well, I knew what he was doing wasn't right. That's why I didn't tell on him. But yeah, I mean, it was almost like we were a couple and we were on this like little, to him, it was like a honeymoon.
That's fucking crazy. Oh my gosh.
How many days were y'all in California before the FBI started coming out?
Sunday, he left. We stayed in Port Arthur Monday. We left the bus Tuesday. We got to LA Thursday at 2 a.m. And so let's see, 19. I was brought back March 1st. So I was kidnapped the 19th and I came home March 1st. So I was going, you know, it was a leap year. We were gone. I was gone 10 days and it was a week before my mother heard from me. So he took me on a Sunday and the next Sunday he let me call home and tell her I was okay.
My gosh. That is so bizarre. How old was he?
He was only 25. And he was like 25 and a month and a half old. I mean, he had just turned 25 February 3rd of that year.
All right. So then what? Like, mom.
All right. So he lets me call home on that Sunday. So over the next couple of days, he's in contact with my mother. Now, the police are at the house. They're recording the phone conversations. They're trying to figure out where we are, asking questions about whether I had like a jacket on because it's February in New York. It had been cold, but we were in California. And he called and he let me call and my mother asked, I had to call collect because we were running out of money. So my mother asked for time and charges. So what that means for those who are younger is when you would make a collect phone call, that was the person you were calling would pay for that. So she accepted the charges and the operator, when we hung up the phone, came back on the line and said, okay, that call was 22 minutes and it was going to cost you $14. So when the operator came back to give her time and charges, Mike Burnett with the Baton Rouge Sheriff's Department got on the phone and said, look, I need to know where that phone call came from. This is a federal investigation. FBI is involved. There's a kidnapping. And she told him it was Samoa Motel, 425 West Catella, Anaheim, California, room 38. And, you know, they contacted Anaheim police and they busted into the room, you know, not too long after the phone call. He was actually on the phone with my mother when the police busted in the room, and they took the phone and hung it up. So my mother, you know, didn't know what if I was in the room or not, because Jeff had told my mother that he had sent me to go to this other people's place. So she didn't know I was in the room. And it was about, I guess, 30 minutes later, they called up and they said, okay, we got him. And she's like, I ain't worried about him. Where's my son? They said, oh, he was right there in the room. He's fine. And they took me outside and I was shaking because they busted the room with guns in my face. And they were like, are you cold? I'm like, no, I'm not cold. I'm scared. They're like, oh, there's no need for you to be scared. I'm like, I'm not scared now. I'm scared because y'all just had guns in my face. Yeah, that was probably the most traumatic part of the whole experience, was them busting in the room, putting guns on me, guns on him.
Oh my,
you know,
gosh.
It freaked me out.
Yeah. Dang. So they get you, and did they take you straight to the airport to go home?
No, they took me straight to the police station. And the Anaheim police questioned me for probably an hour, hour and a half. And then, of course, I denied everything. And he had dyed my hair black, so they were asking about that. Then I went from the Anaheim Police Department to the hospital. That's where they did the rape kit. That's where I knew Jeff was in trouble. You know, they took swabs, and I knew his, I guess we didn't call it DNA back then, but I knew his man material would be discovered. And after that, they took me to this like neglected child home for like a day. And then March 1st, at like 1:10 in the morning, I flew out of LAX to New Orleans. And that's when I was reunited with my parents. And when I got off the plane, there was a news camera there. And I had just woken up and I see a news camera, and I was actually very upset. And at one point, my mother hugs me. And you can see this on film. She hugs me and she whispers, smile and act like you're happy. And I smile. And then the reporter goes, like, you know, what do you think about all this? And I was like, I don't know.
I mean, you were so young. I mean, that is just crazy that they were allowed to even be there and do that.
Well, at that point, they didn't know I'd been sexually abused.
Mm.
Or, you know, nowadays they won't even, you know, name the victim. But my dad used to work at the television station, and he used to entertain clients at a restaurant about less than a half a mile away from the news crew. He bowled with them. He was friends with them. And so that's why they were there. Because daddy called them and said, look, you know, we found my son. And so they went to New Orleans to, you know, film my, you know, return home to my family.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, John Pastorek was the guy who was at the airport in New Orleans, and he's still at the same TV station today on WBRZ Channel 2 in Baton Rouge.
Oh my gosh. That's crazy. So you come home. I'm sure that was a hard adjustment, and everybody's asking you questions. Your mom's probably worried out of her mind what happened while you were gone. What was that like?
Her biggest concern was getting my hair back to blonde. Like, she hated my black hair. So, of course, I went to get my hair dyed, but I went to the next day, we went to the Baton Rouge Sheriff's Department. And that's when things really got tough, because they took me in a room and they interviewed me. I want to say 3 hours. It seemed like 3 hours. It may have been an hour, but they asked me questions, and I told the truth about everything except for, did he touch you? I said, no. And they were mean to me. Like, they were trying to get me to crack. Mm-hmm. And I refused to. And they went back and told my mom and dad. They said, look, we've been interviewing children for years, and either that man didn't touch him, or he's so brainwashed he'll never admit it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were wrong on both.
You were just scared.
Yeah, I knew the hospital report was going to come back. So fast forward a week. My mother's like, Mike Barnett wants to come over and talk to me and your dad, and I don't know why. And I'm thinking to myself, I know why, because the hospital report came back. That's what I was thinking. I didn't tell her that, but that's what I was thinking. So the next day, I get to the bus stop, and my mother's sitting there in the car waiting for me. And I was like, okay, I know exactly what she's here for. So she told my brother, you know what, you just go play with your friends. I need to take Jody. I need to talk to you. So she takes me home. She sits me down on the couch, and she says, Mike Barnett came over today, and the hospital report came back, and it was positive. Now, I knew what that meant, but I was playing stupid. I was like, well, what does that mean? She said, that means that Jeff fooled with you. And I said, yep, he did. And I immediately told the truth. And, you know, we had that moment. And I left the house to go play with my friends. And I don't want to say it was the happiest I've ever been in my life, but I felt like the weight of the world had been lifted off my shoulders. I no longer had to carry around that secret, that burden. And I remember just riding my bike to my friend Crystal's house. And it was just like the most uplifting feeling. Like, I'm done with this. Well, I was mistaken.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't done with it. It only just started.
Yeah.
So now let's fast forward another week. All right. Jeff refused he refused to be extradited back to Louisiana for like 2 weeks. So on March 16th, 1984, police went to go get him and bring him back to Baton Rouge. They went out to L.A., and they were prepared to either drive, fly, whatever Jeff wanted. Jeff said he'd fly. So March 16th, they fly from Los Angeles to Baton Rouge. Well, unbeknownst to the police officers, the program director, his name was Bob Shadell, he's dead now, was having lunch, and he looked at my dad and he said, hey, you know, have they brought your boy back? Not meaning me, meaning Jeff. And daddy said, no, I think he's back already. He goes, they wouldn't tell me anyway. And he goes, no, he's not back. He goes, I think he's coming back tonight. Let me go find out. So he went to the payphone, called the news station, and said, no, he's coming back at 9:08 on, you know, flight. Well, now my dad had the information knowing he was coming back that night. And he had taken a gun from the house. He'd had it. Like, people think it was premeditated, and my dad wasn't that calculating. Like, he didn't plan on it. Like, he didn't plan on shooting. He didn't know what he was going to do, but he had the gun. And when he saw his face at that moment is when he decided, all right, yeah, I'm going to shoot him. And my dad, he was actually talking to his best friend on the phone, and he saw the news camera. So he decided he was going to get across from the news camera because he figured he would walk right by. At first, Mike Burnett came looking. Mike Burnett came walking out from behind the, you know, the wall. And he was looking behind the camera. And there was like, you know, 20, 30 people that had gathered behind the camera thinking, ooh, a celebrity is going to come walking by. Meanwhile, Mike Burnett told me this probably about 6 months ago. He goes, yeah, he goes, all these people were sitting there waiting for like some celebrity. And he goes, they didn't realize it was two drunks and a pedophile. So Mike signals to Bud Connor, all right, come on. So Bud and Jeff come walking down. And I think in my book, I put 16 or 17 steps. And when they got parallel to the camera, my dad turned. He had on a baseball cap and sunglasses, so they didn't recognize him. Turned around, shot him, and killed him. And you can hear Mike Burnett go, whoa, God damn it, Gary, why? Why, Gary? And Mike Burnett actually ran. And my dad and Mike Burnett went to middle school and high school together, so they knew each other. So Mike Burnett actually went and shielded my dad from Bud, because Bud didn't know my dad, and Bud reached for his gun, and Bud was going to shoot him, but Mike stopped him, and then Bud walks over, puts the gun to my dad's head, and goes, you son of a bitch, and he turns around and goes back to Jeff, and you can see him on the video, and he just, like, looks down, and he just shakes his head, and Jeff was dead. He was dead before he hit the ground.
Oh, my gosh.
It's on YouTube for anyone who's listening that wants to see it.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, it was trending today this morning on Twitter. Like, it's crazy how often it pops up on my feed.
That's so crazy. I did watch it the other day. When my sister was telling me this story, we pulled it up and watched it, and it was just, I mean, it's so crazy. The whole story is so crazy, but how it ends with your dad shooting him, which I don't blame him. I mean, any dad would want to kill who did that to their son. So, I mean, that's probably why Mike, you know, shielded your dad, because not only were they friends, but he would have done the same thing if it was his son.
That's most people's feeling, but you know what? It hasn't happened that often. So everybody wants to do it. My dad's the one who did it.
Right.
But that's not the happy ending. The happy ending, for those who don't know the story, is my dad was sentenced to 5 years probation and 300 hours of community service. And a lot of people felt that that was too harsh.
Oh, my God.
Wow. Yeah, I was like, that's a little harsh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Community service.
I mean, I don't even think – I would have given him a pat.
Reward.
Yeah, a pat on the back.
For removing trash.
Yep.
Oh, People will comment, like, they should put a statue outside the airport of my dad. Like, I mean, it's crazy.
Is your dad still alive?
No, he died in October of 2014. He had a stroke in 2011, and so he was in a nursing home for the last couple of years of his life. But he was happy. He was happy in a nursing home. I mean, but he had complications of a stroke, but I mean, he just died watching TV. He was laying in bed watching TV because eyes were still open. Right. We knew he had a blood clot in the back of his brain that could like be released at any point. And I'm assuming that's what happened. The blood clot released and got him.
Yeah. So how did you, like, did they stick you in therapy or, I mean, I don't want to get too personal if you don't want to talk about
it. They had to take in your dad. Well, you got back from that, then your dad did that. But how long were y'all separated?
All right, so daddy shot him on a Friday night. He posted bail Monday morning. So he did do 2 days in Paris prison. Then they brought him to a mental facility, like a psychiatric hospital. And he was there for about a month. And my parents had been separated for like 6 months at the time. And they told my mother that he wasn't going to drink anymore. And my mother said, well, if he's not going to drink, he's welcome home. So daddy moved back home. And that was about a month after the shooting.
Wow.
And then after that, things went back to normal. As far as counseling, I told him I didn't want to go. But they told me I had to go in case it went to trial. They could show that I'd gotten counseling. Mm-hmm. So I went probably for about 6 months to see a psychiatrist. And after 6 months, he told my mother, like, I don't need to see him anymore. He'll be all right.
Was you and your dad's relationship affected by the shooting and all of that?
Actually, At first I was upset at my dad for shooting Jeff. Like, I cared about Jeff. I didn't like him molesting me, but other than that, like, I thought he was a good guy. But I mean, you can't separate the two as an adult, but as a kid, that's how I felt. So at first I was mad at daddy, but it probably was about the summer. So March to probably July or August, that's when I told daddy, like, you know, I don't hate you. I understand why you did what you did. And after that, I mean, I think we had an excellent relationship.
Do you have kids now?
No, I don't.
You don't. I'd be curious, like, what if you would shield and be overprotective of your kids because of what you went through?
I wouldn't say overprotective. I think I would be protective, like most parents should be.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, in 1983, you know, Jeff's like, hey, look, June, I'll bring the kids home after karate practice. And she's thinking, okay, great, I can finish dinner. You didn't have the awareness that we do now. Like, I would let my kids spend a night at no one's house. You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I would hope I wasn't overprotected, but I probably would be.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a situational dependent thing right there.
Oh, my
God. I'm going to tell you why I don't have kids. One night, my cat had been like sitting by the door and he wasn't acting right. And a couple days later, I went to pick him up or pet him. I went to pet him and I felt some wet moisture. And about 11 o'clock at night, well, I smelled my hand and I thought it was poo. When I turned the light on, something had bit him and he had pus and it was infected. It was terrible. Well, this is 11 o'clock at night. I need to get this cat to the vet, and I couldn't bring him to the vet till 7 o'clock in the morning. I didn't sleep, and that's a cat.
Yeah.
So if I had a kid, I don't want that worry.
It's a lot of worry. That's what I'm saying. If I was your mama during all that time, I probably would have had a stroke.
When I was in college, my little brother, he held his breath on the water too long, and literally I had to save him. Like, he drowned. So I pulled him out. I gave him mouth to mouth, and he was in the hospital for the next 2 days. I remember sitting out there with my mother, and she's smoking a cigarette, and she's like, kids, you'll never sleep another day in your life because I don't have them. I don't want them. Like I said, I worry too much about my cat, let alone a child.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. That is crazy.
To me, the saddest part about the whole situation is people know my father is this, you know, vigilante who took justice into his own hands. But my dad was a ploché, and he was the nicest, kindest person that I probably knew. I mean, he would stop and pick up stray animals. You know, I didn't drink in college, but every time I met him somewhere, hey, you want a beer? I'm like, no, I don't drink. He would buy beers for people. His job was to entertain clients. He was a salesman. So for him to do what he did, he had to be in so much pain to do that. And to me, that's the saddest thing, is that, like, I knew I was going to be fine. He didn't.
Yeah.
If he could have looked in a crystal ball and saw who I was in the future, he probably wouldn't have did what he did. But then again, what he did helped shape me. So there's that dynamic. But my dad was really the kindest, sweetest man that I knew. Him and my uncle, they were wonderful people.
I can tell you that if that happened to our son, I probably would have done the same thing. Same with Marcus. I mean, that it's just a parental instinct to want to eliminate someone or something that hurts your child like that. Even if you are going to be okay. I mean, that is pure parental instinct, don't you think, babe?
No,
absolutely.
Comment on it. I don't know what I would do. I'm going to leave it at that. Just leave it open so nobody even fucking tries it.
Yeah. Don't try it.
You don't have the imagination like I do. Trust me.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of people say that. A lot of people say that he got off easy.
Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine it, but oh my gosh. I would just think, I mean, even when someone hurts their feelings, you want to hurt that person. It's just that parental instinct, like, okay, you have to, it's almost like an animal instinct. You have to protect your children and at all costs.
My dad, we were raised Catholic, and my dad believed in the Ten Commandments. Mm-hmm. Maybe not the don't cheat on your wife, but I mean, he did his community service at the church. So my dad was really religious, but he believed thou shalt not kill unless you screw with his son or screw his son.
Yeah.
And that trumped it. So my dad, he'd live with that burden that he took a human life. He didn't like that he took a human life, but he didn't regret what he did.
Yeah. Well, how did you get, I mean, I would think that that would, it just shows your mental strength to be able to move past that. Like, it sounds like you were getting off the bus before your dad even did that. So they obviously sent you back to school right afterwards. Was it an easy transition or?
Well, it was fairly easy to be, and I described this in the book, but it was really a great moment. So I come back to school. Now, we had dyed my hair back to blonde, but it didn't come out blonde. Like it came out like really crappy. Like I look like a golden retriever. And so I walk into the gym, because before class started, we'd all meet up in the gym. So I walk in the gym, and I look across the basketball court, and my friends were sitting on the stage. So I walk across the basketball court, and literally the gym went quiet. They watched me walk across the basketball court. And I walk up to my friends, and they're just sitting there looking at me with like their just look on their face like they had seen a ghost. And I walked up to them, and I said, "What? Y'all are looking at me like I've been kidnapped or something." And they started laughing. A couple of the girls were crying. But that's when they realized I was still the same Jody that was before I was taken. So then we get to my homeroom class, and they have a big banner on the wall that said, "Welcome back, Jody." And on the bulletin board, they had a picture of me with my signature. I'd signed somebody's like tablet and my signature underneath it. And next to that picture, and you can Google this, it said the boy in the plastic bubble dies. John Travolta played the kid in the TV movie, The Boy in the Plastic Bubble.
Yeah.
And it said, boy in the plastic bubble dies right next to my picture. And I looked at my teacher and I said, y'all didn't give me much of a chance, did y'all?
Oh my gosh.
And that's when they realized, all right, Jody's Jody.
Yeah. That's a good Cajun sense of humor.
Yeah.
Well, my favorite, if you go to Amazon and read like the comments, one of them said, this book is funny.
Yeah.
And to me, that was a compliment because I wanted my book not just to be, you know, rape and killing. I wanted to have humor in it too.
Yeah. Well, humor gets you through the darkest times.
So was it awkward around the house, or how long did everything just kind of smoothed out and went in its own direction?
It's almost amazing how everything just kind of went back to normal.
Yeah.
The first month or so was awkward because, you know, daddy was still trying to be daddy. Like, you need to go to bed. And, you know, now that I'm older, I knew what he was wanting me to go to bed for, but he hadn't been there for like 6 months. So I was able to stay up till, you know, 11, 12 o'clock without daddy telling me to go to bed. But, you know, now that I'm older, I know he wanted me to go to bed because he wanted to spend some alone time with my mother.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad that you like overcame all of that and were able to live. I mean, a lot of people would turn into a hot mess after that.
Yeah. I mean, what is the driving force in that direction?
All right. So in 1991, we got a call from the Geraldo Rivera talk show to go on a show. And I wanted to go to New York. I'm like, hey, free trip to New York. Let's go. So me and daddy flew to New York City. We filmed the show. And that's all I'm thinking of. Hey, this was great. First time to New York. Wonderful. Well, the show aired. We filmed it in April and it aired June. Well, about a week or two after the show aired, I got a call from Mike Barnett, same sheriff deputy that was like throughout the whole case. And he called me and he said, look, I want you to notice this is going to be on the news tonight. It's going to be in the papers tomorrow. He goes, we just arrested this pastor who had been sexually abusing these two boys. And one of the boys saw you on the Geraldo show and told his mom, and we just arrested him. And that's the moment when I realized that, wow, I could take this story and I could use something negative and turn it into something positive. And so, you know, when you hear people go, if I could only just help one person, mm-hmm. Nope, I want to help as many as possible. I'm not going to settle for just one. So that's why I decided that I would share my story and I would, you know, write the book. At college, I joined a group called Men Against Violence, and we would do programs on campus about conflict resolution. I had a Mountain Dew. That's why I'm kind of jittery. Then I ended up getting a job in Pennsylvania at a place called Victim Services Center of Montgomery County, which is just outside of Philadelphia. Our office is located in Norristown, and that's what we did. I would go to schools and I would do, you know, keep in touch with safe and healthy. I would do, you know, dating violence. I would do sexual assault risk reductions to high school colleges. And that's what I kind of dedicated myself to doing.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Because it's hard to do that, man. It's hard to turn around something in a situation like that, especially when it affects the whole family and push it into something that not only helps the family, but helps those around you.
I remember I was going on one of the talk shows. I've been on Oprah, Montel, Maury, back when Maury was like serious. And I remember one of the family members saying, why doesn't Jody just let sleeping dogs lie? And I'm like, because I feel like I can make an impact on other people. I can be a role model to survivors of sexual assault to let them know that, you know, I'm not scarred for life. I'm not damaged goods. I'm not ruined. I didn't have a traumatic childhood. I love my childhood. I wouldn't change my childhood for anything.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess if I had to, I would. But it's made me the person I am.
That's awesome. So would you encourage more when you do these talks to sexual abuse forums or whatever, do you encourage people to actually come out and tell their parents immediately if someone touches them, or like psychologically, what's the best thing to do for that?
Well, when I was working at Victim Services, we would teach the children safety rules, no go and tell. If someone touches you inappropriately, you say no to that person, you go, you get away from that person, and then you tell an adult. Now, I've kind of shifted my way of thinking because we're going to put the burden on the kid. Like, it's your job to make sure you don't get sexually abused. I think it's the parent's job to make sure they don't allow their children too far away.
Both, probably, because you're training the next generation not to let it happen.
But you still want to have those open conversations with your kid. Like when I was young, like probably 8 or 9 years old, I think it was 81, so I'd have been 9. They had a show called Fallen Angel. It was like a TV movie. And my mother sat us down and made us watch it. And she explained to us that there were people out there that would take advantage of children. And this guy was like getting the kids into like child porn or like taking naked pictures of them. And so when Jeff first he ever touched my private parts, I thought to myself, oh, wow, he's like one of them people mommy told me about. So that's why I never blamed myself. It's because I was prepared. I knew that there were people out there. Again, I'm still 10, so I don't know how to tell her. But I mean, looking back, if you look at how he kind of integrated himself and groomed the family and started spending time with me, especially, mm-hmm. I tell parents all the time, if someone wants to spend more time with your child than you do, that's a red flag. That's not a red flag. It's a red rocket.
Mm-hmm. That is so crazy. Oh, that's hard. It's for us, we have a 10-year-old boy, so we're like over here.
Possibly, we talk to him about it all the time.
Yeah, we always talk to him about it.
Don't let him touch you. You feel uncomfortable, you know, just walk away. And they're getting to the age now. They'll throw me attitude. So,
well, now, and our two little ones are 15 months apart. So our daughter is just a year younger, and she'll kick him in his private, and he's like, "Mom, Addy touched me in my no-no square." Oh my god! But she just kicked him.
I don't think he's too young. If you got a 10-year-old, you can sit him down and watch the 15-minute. Like the little ESPN E60 that we're on, and you can definitely talk to him about it. I mean, bring it up. I mean, don't obsess over it, but every time a teachable moment occurs, you know, talk to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, thank you for sharing your story and being vulnerable to that. I mean, I know that's got to be, you've probably done it so many times, but no matter how many times you tell a story about the worst week of your life, we know that personally, that it's never fun. So thank you for opening up and sharing that, and it will help other people.
I mean, I understand when your point of view and your perspective, and there's probably there's some wisdom that's curled in there now, actually, even for as young as you are. Those experiences bring that out, and it's hard for people to understand. I had the best childhood ever. I wouldn't change one thing in my life, and I say that with complete confidence. And people are like, man, you've been to hell and back multiple times. Like, I sure have. You know, somebody had to go through it so they could come back around and tell you about it, teach you about it. I mean,
exactly.
I mean, you want somebody else to go through it? I love my friends and family so much, I wouldn't want them to go through it. And it upsets them that I have to do it, but then so be it. Somebody's got to pull it, right? And then it just kind of, you talk about it, and you people around you, they kind of rebuild that confidence. So, good job, man. Don't never quit, man. Never quit.
Yeah, you have an awesome never quit story.
And we're family.
I know.
And we're family.
On top of everything else, it's like, yeah, pull over. Get your ass somewhere where I can hear what you're saying.
And your niece is friends with our son, Hunter.
Yeah, no, my niece and him are really good friends. Like literally, when you emailed me, I talked to her, and she's like, I just talked to him earlier today.
Yeah, he, when I was emailing back and forth with you, I called him, and he was like, yeah, she just Snapchatted me. I think they talk often, so.
Well, and then I told my mother, I got contacted. They had a podcast, Lone Survivor, and my mother goes, oh, that's Mason's friend.
Yeah.
I was like, no. I mean, this was the one with the book and the movie. She's like, no, that's Mason's friend. I'm like, no, it can't be. It's got to be.
That's so funny.
Other person or whatever.
Yeah, that's our oldest graduated from LSU in May, and he just moved back to Houston. But he loved it. He had a good old college
experience.
He had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
LSU's been known to do that. Now, the last year and a half, I don't know how much fun college is, but I know back in the day it was wonderful.
Well, he was there when they won the national championship.
Oh, yeah, had a hell of a time.
Yeah, he had a great time, and Marcus got to go hang out with his fraternity and do all that fun stuff. So
that happened one time.
Well, the next time y'all are in Baton Rouge or the next time in Houston, we'll have to get together.
Definitely.
We would love that.
So thank you again, man. Thanks for taking the time, brother. We appreciate you.
Yeah, God have a safe you. Drive.
Thanks, Jody.
Thanks for having me.
Later, man. Bro.
Bye.
All right. Bye.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for listening to another episode of the podcast. Jody, thank you so much for sharing your story, man. It was just insane how you were able to overcome so much, and what you're doing now is even more important to just be able to be a voice of reason and someone who can just offer guidance in such a hard experience in life. Thank you so much again for sharing your story. Hey, if you guys haven't already, make sure you're following us on social media, teamneverquit.com/social. If you're not on Patreon, you should be, because we are doing some awesome stuff there, and we've got some amazing things in the works. That's patreon.com/teamneverquit. You're going to want to check that out. There's all brand new merch in the store. So if you haven't gotten a t-shirt, if you haven't gotten an autographed book, if you haven't got stickers, bracelet, whatever it may be, there's a bunch of new stuff in the shop, shop.teamneverquit.com. We will see you guys next week.